Hi class, this is your professor, Dr. Fields. We are in the final third of the course. So this lecture and the subsequent lectures are all going to be on exam number 3. Before I start with this next new lecture, I just wanted to give you guys some tips in terms of making the most out of these lectures and really actively listening and studying. One thing that I quickly came to discover when I was an undergrad is if you're just listening to the lecture and reading the slides or reading from the book, you're really not actively listening. Now, one of the problems that I think that a lot of you are experiencing is because you have the slides, you don't really feel like you need to take notes. When you're not writing down information, you're not retaining information as well. That is a research-proven fact. So one of the things I might recommend is you actually taking some notes while you're listening to the lecture and looking at the slides, like you would in class. The other thing is when we're talking about these different disorders and conditions, in order to like actively listen and really comprehend the information, don't just listen to me rambling and read off the slides. Really try to process the information and understand the implications. Like, what does this mean? What is this like for a person to have this kind of disorder? What kind of experience would that be? Visualize some of these conditions and the impact that they have on people. Try to relate the information, especially the various aspects of the disorder and all the hypothesized causes. Really kind of looking at how they all kind of work together and, have this interplay. That's very important, rather than just simply, like I said, reading off slides and listening to me drone on. I am definitely a little bit out of my element. I'm not used to doing, audio lectures. I'm used to doing podcasts, but I'm not used to actually teaching this way. So it's a little bit different. In class, you probably saw me. I was a little bit more dynamic because I had an audience. And I don't have that audience now. I mean, I have an audience, but I can't see you. So it's a little bit different of an experience. So we all really have to make some modifications in order to make sure that this is the best possible learning experience. Okay? All right. With that being said, one thing that occurred to me. Up until this point, looking at the syllabus, I thought like I was dead on in terms of how much lecture time needed to be devoted to each topic. All the way up until I came to this topic. And when I started preparing the lecture notes for this next unit, which is sexual dysfunctions, paraphilic disorders, and gender dysphoria, I quickly came to realize that one lecture is just not going to be enough. This topic or topics are really going to require two lectures. And that's fine because don't fret, you're not going to have an extra lecture here. What I've come to realize is that some of the other lectures, particularly psychosis and schizophrenia that I devoted to 2 days is probably only going to require 1 day. In fact, I'm pretty sure of that. Or that might be a day and a half, and personality disorders will be a day and a half rather than two. So just so you know, there's a slight adjustment. This lecture is actually going to be broken up into two parts, just like with neurodevelopmental disorders, just because there's so much information. Why is there so much information? Well, sex is a big part of our lives. It's an important area of life for many of us. So, therefore, it shouldn't be surprising that there are so many anomalies or deviations in terms of sexual behavior, and that we would need to devote more time to this. Okay? All right. Like always, I have a couple videos. I couldn't find any videos on sexual dysfunction, probably because a lot of people are a little bit embarrassed to, speak openly about those kind of issues. But I did find a pretty good video on a paraphilic disorder and on gender dysphoria. Okay? So watch those videos, and then after you're done with that, you can resume the lecture. Okay, I'm assuming you watch those two videos. So, like I was saying, sex is an important area of life for many of us. So, it does encompass a lot of different types of aspects and behaviors. One thing that I want to point out is that's very different now when we're talking about sexual disorders or dysfunctions is that homosexuality used to be considered a mental disorder. Now, thankfully, we've moved away from that conceptualization, and we no longer view being gay as being a disorder or abnormal in a, a negative kind of sense. All right. So, really, when you look at being gay or homosexuality, the best way to look at it is just that it's an anomaly. It's not typical. The large majority of us are heterosexual. But it's certainly not to say that there is something problematic or inherently wrong with it. Okay? Now, of course, if an individual is distressed about being gay, and that this can certainly happen depending on, what geographic region you were growing up in as a kid, New York, especially New York City, tends to be a lot more progressive and evolved and accepting, but there are still many areas of the country and certainly the world that are not so accepting. And even here in New York City, a lot of people who are gay still, are subject to mistreatment, and different kinds of verbal abuse or bullying or what have you, especially when they're a kid. So certainly, although being gay is not a disorder, it certainly can present with certain kinds of challenges, and these challenges could leave one to be susceptible to having some kind of anxiety or depressive disorder, okay? Or an unhealthy, or developing an unhealthy way of coping with this distress in terms of developing an eating disorder or some kind of addictive disorder. Okay? All right. Controversy still remains regarding the inclusion of a disorder for, quote, a person feeling compelled to change his or her sexual identity. This new category is called gender dysphoria, and it implies a negative emotional component that exists in this, quote, sexual identity disorder. Okay? So, in other words, I really have issue with this title or term, and I also have issue with it being included in the DSM. I think just like homosexuality is no longer considered a disorder, one day this will no longer become, considered a disorder as well. Quite recently, the World Health Organization, that's WHO, if you can see that in slide two, WHO, it's all capitalized, so that's not a typo. That's actually the acronym for the World Health Organization. Very recently, just formally declared this not to be a disorder. So I'm hoping that the committee of the DSM and the next revision of the DSM also follows suit and no longer looks at this as a disorder. Because again, just like being gay presents with a lot of challenges, you know, so does having some kind of disparity in terms of the sex you were born with and the sex that you feel you really are, or the gender that you were born with and the gender you feel that you really are. Certainly, that can present challenges. It can be very confusing to an individual. It can be, it certainly can, you know, solicit negative reactions from people. But, you know, to say it's a disorder is saying that it's problematic in the sense that, you know, there's something wrong with you, you know, in a negative or bad way. And it's just really the person was born that way. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody would really choose to be gay or to be in a situation where they don't feel that their gender really reflects, you know, who they truly are. Just because of the challenges it creates. You know, it just creates a lot of challenges for people. But because these different conditions, you know, have a lot of challenges, right? It doesn't mean that they're a mental disorder, right? So I'm really hoping that that gets changed. What else was I thinking about that? You know, certainly, you know, they can have a disorder in terms of if you have this condition and it, you know, you have a lot of distress and confusion, and it, you know, is really stressful for you to deal with the types of challenges inherent with it, then certainly you could wind up having a major depressive disorder or some kind of anxiety condition or some substance abuse issue or misuse issue rather, you know, to try to cope with these, you know, difficulties and the confusion and everything else. That can absolutely happen, but in and by itself, it's really not a mental disorder, okay? And we're going to talk more about the better way to view this when we get to that topic. All right. So these are a few words that I want to talk about, a few key concepts I wanted to discuss before getting into the different categories. All right. Also, it is important to know that it is very difficult to define normal when discussing sexual practices, as there is so much diversity to them. The best way to view abnormal or dysfunctional sexual practice is that which causes the person or others distress. Okay? So if it's causing you distress, and that's our catchphrase, right, that we see all the time in all these different disorders, it has a major life impairment, it's causing you distress. If it causes the person or others distress, okay, then you're looking at something that is dysfunctional and some kind of disorder. Okay? And I mean distress directly, right? Also, this statement by Kinsey, who is a very famous researcher in sexual practices, best summarizes variations in sexual behavior. The only unnatural act is that which you cannot perform. So that is another interesting way of looking at it. Okay? All right. Basically, we have three categories in terms of the sexual disorders, sexual dysfunctions, paraphilic disorders, and gender dysphoria. All right? So the first category we're going to discuss is sexual dysfunctions. This has to do with performance issues when it comes to the actual act of having sex, okay? And when we're talking about, you know, dysfunction or difficulties with sexual response, we're talking about three key areas that we're looking at. So the first area is desire. The second area is excitement and arousal. And the third area is orgasm. And these three areas are a little bit different for men and women. Okay? Now, these aspects do not always occur in their listed, or rather, a linear kind of sequence. In other words, it's not always the case that desire comes first, followed by excitement and arousal, followed by orgasm. Sometimes they can co-occur. Desire and excitement can happen at the same time. Or sometimes one can come before the other. One may get aroused and then become desirous, and then that may eventually lead to orgasm. Okay? So these are not to be viewed in a linear sequence. They typically occur in this sequence, but not always. And this is a different, newer conceptualization as compared to those classic researchers, Masters and Johnson, who came up with their own linear stage of the sexual response cycle. Okay? So sexual dysfunctions occur at similar rates for both gay and straight people. Okay. Now, moving on to the different kinds of sexual dysfunctions. The first one we're going to talk about has to do with dysfunction in the stage of desire. Okay. So that would be the male hypoactive sexual desire disorder for men. And let's take a look at the criteria here. Persistently or recurrently deficient or absent sexual erotic thoughts or fantasies and desire for sexual activity. The judgment of deficiency is made by the clinician, taking into account factors that affect sexual functioning, such as age and general and social cultural context of the individual's life. So, we've said this from day one. It's very important to look at many different aspects before we say a behavior is abnormal or problematic. And this could not be truer for sex, because sex, there are so many deviations and differences in terms of, what culture you're from, in terms of your developmental age, in terms of your gender, in terms of your background. I mean, there's just so many things involved in this, okay? And your biological makeup, I mean, everything, right? So we really have to make sure that we don't jump to include a conclusion and say just because this behavior is different from the normal that it's problematic, all right? And that's true for all these kinds of disorders we're going to talk about. Okay, the symptoms in criterion A have persisted for a minimum duration of approximately 6 months. We usually always have a criterion about duration, right? The symptoms in criterion A cause clinically significant distress in the individual. So you may not have a lot of sexual desire, but if it's not a problem for you, we don't consider it a disorder. There are people that have a very low sex drive. They're not that interested in sex. Are they outside the norm? Sure. But there are plenty of people that are totally fine with that and, live a very fulfilling life. And it's just not as big of a need for them. And that's fine. If it causes you distress and you're upset by it, in other words, then it's a problem. Okay, criterion D, the sexual dysfunction is not better explained by a non-sexual mental disorder or as a consequence of severe relationship distress or other significant stresses and is not attributable to the effects of a substance or medication. This is very important because a lot of sexual dysfunctions are related to substances and medications. We're talking both prescription medications and recreational drugs, psychoactive substances. We're also talking about medical conditions. One that sticks out in my mind is diabetes. Another one that is very important in terms of looking at this as being a disorder or not is there some kind of major stressor going on in the individual's life? Because that can affect sexual performance. And also, if they are in a relationship, Are there, relationship difficulties between them and their partner that absolutely could lead to that? Okay? All right. And then we have these different specifiers, right? So, lifelong, it's been something they've had since the time they've been sexually active. Acquired, it's happened more recently. Generalized or situational. Generalized is it happens in almost all these kinds of sexual situations. Situational only in certain kinds of situations. All right. Okay, moving on. For men with arousal difficulties, which is known as erectile disorder, criterion A, at least one of the three following symptoms must be experienced on almost all or all, that's about 75 to 100% of the occasions of sexual activity, in identified situational contexts, or if generalized, in all contexts. Marked difficulty in obtaining an erection during sexual activity. Marked difficulty in maintaining an erection until the completion of sexual activity. Marked decrease in erectile rigidity. Okay? The symptoms in criterion A have persisted for a minimum duration of approximately 6 months. They cause clinically significant distress, and they are not better explained by other aspects. Substances, medical conditions, etc., etc., etc. They could be acquired or lifelong, situational, meaning only occurring in certain situations with certain partners, or generalized in basically all situations with all partners. Okay? Okay, so now for females, moving on, we have female sexual interest arousal disorder. This kind of combines those first two stages or aspects of the sexual response cycle, saying that this disorder is really looking at difficulties in either or, right? Either in sexual desire or arousal. They seem to happen more simultaneously for women than men, and that's why they're kind of combined in this disorder here for women. All right, so looking at these criteria, it's a persistent or recurrent inability to attain or to maintain until completion of the sexual activity an adequate lubrication swelling response of sexual excitement. That is how females get aroused, right? Men get aroused by having an erection, women get aroused by having this lubrication swelling response. If you think this is embarrassing for you guys, you could just imagine being in my shoes discussing some of this. I thought we should have some comic relief, right? Okay. The disturbance causes marked distress or interpersonal difficulty. And that really should also be included in the male hypoactive sexual desire disorder as well. Not just significant distress in the individual, but also a lot of times it causes interpersonal difficulty. The sexual dysfunction is not better accounted for by these other factors, right? And then we have these different specifiers here. Okay. And again, if the woman is not bothered by this, and they are fine with having a low sex drive, or they're fine with not being very excited at the prospect of having sex. They don't have sex very often and they're okay with that. It's not a disorder. It's only a disorder if you're upset by it. Okay, moving on. We're going to now talk about the orgasmic disorders. We'll do the men first. So for men, there is what's called premature ejaculation. This is a persistent or recurrent pattern of ejaculation occurring during partnered sexual activity within approximately 1 minute following vaginal penetration and before the individual wishes it. Note, although the diagnosis of premature or early ejaculation may be applied to individuals engaged in non-vaginal sexual activities, specific duration criteria have not been established for these activities. So this is very specific. And, I mean, I would argue that if a guy is not happy with ejaculating, sooner than what he intended, that, that can be considered some kind of problem, right? That would hence be amenable to treatment. But this is the specific criteria for, what we refer to as premature ejaculation for men. Criterion B, the symptom in Criterion A must have been present for at least 6 months and must be experienced on almost all occasions of sexual activity, approximately 75 to 100%. So what this basically means is, listen, it happens sometimes that, you have an orgasm as a guy before you intend. And if that happens occasionally or once in a while, especially if it's with a new partner, right? Or, your first sexual experience, or you haven't had sex in a while, these kind of things are normal, right? But if it's happening a lot and it's causing you distress, then we're looking more at the disorder, okay? Or it being a disorder, rather. And then again, we have this other rule out. We call this a rule out. The sexual dysfunction is not better explained by other things. That's essentially what it's talking about. Okay. Moving on. For females, female orgasmic disorder. This is a recurrent and persistent. Oh, wait. I'm sorry. Let me back up for one sec. There is also another orgasmic disorder for men called delayed ejaculation. There's a lot of men out there that might not think this is such a problem. But this, what that is essentially when a man has a lot of difficulty having an orgasm, and sometimes is unable to have one. That happens actually a lot. A lot of those cases, I should say, are really due to medications. There are certain kinds of medications that cause that. So that's usually what that is due to. However, not always. And if that's the case, then, and that's a problem for the guy, then of course that could also be something that would be amenable to treatment. Okay, going on. For females, female orgasmic disorder, recurrent and persistent inhibition of the female orgasm as manifested by a delay in or absence of orgasm following a normal sexual excitement phase during sexual activity that is judged by the clinician to be adequate in focus, intensity, and duration. This is very important, and it's not only important for this particular disorder, it's important to look at for all the kinds of disorders. The person does not necessarily have a disorder if there is not enough foreplay or there's a, there's a not enough stimulation to excite them. Certain things have to be adequate and in place, so to speak, in order to be properly aroused and then to the point of eventually achieving orgasm. So that's important when we're considering these different kinds of disorders, So in other words, it could be the partner's fault. The same individual may also meet the criteria for inhibited sexual excitement if at other times there is a problem with the excitement phase of sexual activity. In such cases, both categories of psychosexual dysfunction should be noted. We're referring to these as psychosexual dysfunctions because we're saying that they're due to psychological factors, not medical or substance-related factors. Okay? In other words, we've ruled them out, right? So all these disorders are looked upon as being psychologically based. Some women are able to experience orgasm during non-coital clitoral stimulation, but are unable to experience it during coitus, that's sexual penetration, In the absence of manual clitoral stimulation, there is evidence to suggest that in some instances this represents a pathological inhibition that justifies this diagnosis, whereas in other instances it represents a normal variation of the female sexual response. This really has to be determined by both the patient and the clinician in terms of, whether or not it's pathological. Which is a harsh sounding word, but it basically just means it's abnormal or problematic. Okay? So, different things to keep in mind. And again, the reason why they're so specific and so hesitant to say that this is definitely a disorder in this case or what have you is because there is such variation in sexual practice and sexual response. This difficult judgment, it goes on to say, is assisted by a thorough sexual evaluation, which may even require a trial of treatment. And sometimes that's how we discover whether or not it's a disorder or the severity of it in terms of how they respond to any kind of treatment, whether it be psychological treatment or medical treatment. And then we have our rule out down there. The disturbance is not caused exclusively by organic factors such as a physical disorder or medication or another mental disorder. Okay? All right, one more. This is also for females. Genitopelvic pain penetration disorder. This is a persistent or recurrent difficulty with one or more of the following: vaginal penetration during intercourse, marked vulvo-vaginal or pelvic pain during vaginal intercourse or penetration attempts, marked fear or anxiety about vulvo-vaginal or pelvic pain in anticipation of, during, or as a result of vaginal penetration, marked tensing or tightening of the pelvic floor muscles during attempted vaginal penetration. The symptoms and criterion A have persisted for a minimum duration of approximately 6 months, and they cause significant distress, and they are not due to other factors. Okay? Different kinds of cultural expectations, different kinds of experiences, all these things have to kind of be looked at and teased apart before we rush to say that this is some kind of abnormal problematic disorder. All right? So just keep that in mind for really all of these different kinds of sexual disorders that we're going to be talking about. Okay, let's look at some prevalence rates. For male hypoactive sexual disorder, for men aged 16 to 44, the lifetime prevalence rate is about 1.8%. For erectile disorder, ages 18 to 59, lifetime rate is 5%. For female sexual interest and arousal disorder, lifetime rate is between 7.4 to 14%. Whenever you see a large range like that, it's usually like a best estimate, based off of some specific studies or what have you. Premature ejaculation disorder, lifetime prevalence rate of 21%, and female orgasmic disorder, lifetime prevalence rate of 25. Actually, let me back up. Orgasm difficulty for women is the only information we have that's related to female orgasmic disorder. That's a lifetime prevalence rate of 25%. However, you know that a disorder is much more than just having a certain difficulty. It's also being distressed about it, right? And certainly that it could be due to other factors. So the psychological female orgasmic disorder, we don't know what the exact lifetime prevalence rate is for, but we do know for general orgasm difficulties for women is about 25%. So right there you can see the orgasmic difficulties for both men and women tend to have the highest prevalence rates. And lastly, genitopelvic pain penetration disorder for women, The lifetime prevalence rate is possibly 6%, but we really don't have any firm data. That's a real best guess kind of estimate there. Okay. All right. Moving on. All right, let's talk about some possible causes of sexual dysfunctions. Okay, so different kinds of medical conditions or physical disorders that could lead to sexual dysfunctions, particularly with erectile disorder for men, are things like kidney disease, diabetes, vascular disease. Different substances can cause sexual dysfunctions, such as different kinds of psychoactive substances like alcohol, cocaine, heroin, etc., etc., etc. I mentioned before different kinds of medications, hypertensives for blood pressure, and many psychotropic medications such as antidepressants, especially SSRIs and antipsychotics, can also cause sexual problems. These have been known to cause not only erection problems in men, but also orgasm difficulties such as delayed ejaculation, which is what we talked about briefly for men, and can also cause sexual difficulties for women as well. Now, this has always stood out in my mind as such a double curse for so many people because, here you are, you're depressed. And we know that depression can often cause sexual difficulties, especially with desire, right? And that can certainly affect arousal. So you go and you get medication to treat the depression, and maybe you're also hoping, as a secondary benefit, that not only will it treat the medication, but it will also help you perform better sexually because you won't be depressed anymore. And lo and behold, you find out that almost all the different kinds of antidepressant medications out there have some kind of potential for causing sexual difficulties. It's so unfortunate. There is one antidepressant, Wellbutrin, that tends to have the lowest potential of causing sexual difficulties. But I always kind of looked at that as, man, jeez. Okay, so now understand that if a sexual dysfunction is caused by a medical condition, a psychoactive substance, or medication, then it is not a psychological sexual dysfunction. It's a sexual dysfunction caused by these factors. Remember, the sexual dysfunctions that we reviewed, they've all, in order to be diagnosed with those sexual dysfunctions we just reviewed, you have to have had ruled out all these other factors. But we bring this up because, they are very common causes of sexual dysfunctions. And if you're a therapist, you have a patient that's complaining about one of these kinds of disorders or difficulties, then you certainly want to make sure you have an in-depth interview that goes over their substance use, medication, any kind of medical conditions they have that possibly could explain it. Okay? And also, some men may have an overactive sympathetic nervous system, which makes them less tolerant of sexual stimulation, which then could lead to premature ejaculation disorder. Some people just get excited too easily. Okay. So, assuming we've ruled out those different kinds of biological causes, what kind of psychological reasons are there for the development of a sexual dysfunction? So, let's go on to slide 12 here. Well, contrary to what was believed for a long time, anxiety in and by itself is not so strongly related to disorders of desire and arousal. Depression can be related to desire, but usually in the sense that the person loses interest in sex and many pleasurable activities for that matter. For people who are interested in sex but have difficulty increasing desire and arousal, problems that usually occur together, the main culprit seems to be difficulty maintaining attention. So that it's not the anxiety that is directly responsible for the arousal difficulty, but it's the attention problems that are more directly related to it, that are a byproduct of many anxiety conditions. And, you know, one of the disorders that stands out in my mind in terms of this being responsible for the most is erectile disorder for men. Certainly, it could also interfere with the female sexual response cycle as well. It could interfere with her ability to get aroused if her attention is, you know, not focused on the actual moment. And it certainly can cause difficulties with her reaching climax or orgasm. Okay? So why? Why is this such a big influence for the arousal disorders? People with desire arousal disorders, due to or exacerbated, if there are biological factors, by psychological factors, have a tendency to have a negative thinking style. So, you know, they'll think, I'll probably not be able to get excited and or perform, you know, particularly for men, or that they will underreport their level of arousal. They will think they are less sexually excited than they actually are, which would be for men and women. And they experience negative affects, such as sadness and upset. So, in other words, rather than focusing more on the sexual situation and cues, they focus on negative thoughts and avoid focusing on stimulation because they expect that there will be none, which leads to a negative mood that is contrary to arousal and excitement. So, all this misdirected attention takes away from the moment. And, you know, really negatively impacts their ability to get aroused and for women to maybe even have an orgasm. So this then, you know, this poor sexual experience then conforms, or I should say, confirms rather, sorry, their negative thoughts, and most importantly, keeps the focus away from the immediate sexual experience. So this is, you know, like this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where I don't think I'm going to be able to perform, and if I don't, that'll be horrible, horrible, horrible. And then being distracted with all these thoughts and feeling badly then actually leads to problems with performance for a guy or a woman in terms of, you know, whether or not she's getting lubricated enough or excited enough. And then also for a woman, possibly interfering with their ability to have an orgasm. Okay? And it's a vicious cycle. You know, then they have a poor sexual experience, and the next sexual experience makes them even more worried, and they think that, you know, the same thing's gonna happen there, and all these worries and distracting thoughts, and a lot of times will increase the probability it will happen again. Now, for premature ejaculation disorder for men, anxiety, in contrast, is directly involved. So, for the arousal disorders for men and women, and for the female orgasmic disorders, it's more about the lack of attention or focus because of these distracting thoughts that are related to anxiety. So, that anxiety is indirectly related, but not directly. For premature ejaculation disorder, anxiety is directly involved. So, for a man, he could have worrisome thoughts and heightened anxiety and thus general excitement, right? And then when he's too excited, that could lead to having an orgasm earlier than he intended. Also, people who experience excitement at a higher than normal level, which is related to anxiety disorders, would also be another closely related cause of this disorder. So, just having this kind of susceptibility to getting overexcited, you know, to experiencing more arousal than you'd want. So, we have disorders where we don't have enough arousal, or disorders where we have too much. And then for females with genitopelvic pain penetration disorder, anxiety may also be the culprit, such as leading to them tensing up during, for example, I'm using an example here, like if you've ever tensed up during a medical procedure, right? Your muscles get tense, or definitely a dental procedure. I don't know about you, but I definitely tense up for that. Your muscles will get tense, right? Well, the same thing can happen during sex for women if they're very anxious about it and they tense up too much. Then that could also be related to the cause of this disorder for them. Okay? Okay. Social cultural causes. Moving on to slide 13. This is another important consideration when we're talking about sexual dysfunction. A dysfunctional romantic relationship, negative interpersonal attitudes inherited from unhealthy family experiences, traumatic sexual experiences, and cultural discouragement can all play a part in somebody having a sexual dysfunction. Also, myths perpetuated by the media and society that puts pressure on people can lead to unreal expectations and resulting in a negative sexual self-concept. So I kind of came up with that term, I think. Sexual self-concept means maybe a better term would be sexual self-esteem. Your feelings about yourself in terms of your sexual performance, okay? Your feelings about yourself in terms of being able to enjoy sex and feeling comfortable with that and feeling confident as a sexual being. All those kinds of connotations would be related to that. You read like these magazines like Cosmopolitan's tends to be one of the more likely culprits, but there's a lot of news programs and different things you'll read about sex, and the information many times is not based off research or actual reality. Hearing about what you should be able to do as a woman sexually or as a man sexually can make someone feel pretty badly about themselves if they don't, so to speak, measure up. So that these myths can then put performance anxiety on us and have and lead to sexual problems. So it's not a good thing. Okay, moving on to slide 14. So let's talk about some treatment options for sexual dysfunctions. On slide 14, we're going to talk about medical treatment, pharmacotherapy, and psychotropic options. For men, particularly if they suffer from hypoactive desire or erectile dysfunction disorders, there are medications available. I'm sure you've heard of them. They're very, very popular. Sildenafil, whose brand name is known as Viagra, Tadalafil, Cialis, Verdenafil, Levitra, and there's many more. There's also a vacuum device therapy where you put a vacuum device over the man's penis and that actually increases blood flow to that region, thus enabling them to have an erection. And there are also, in the most severe cases, select surgical procedures. Now, of course, these options certainly can be for men who have medical conditions that are causing their erectile dysfunction or desire disorders, but they also can be used as to treat, a psychological sexual dysfunction, which is what we've been primarily talking about here. So, for example, let's say a man has performance issues, and we talked about, that vicious self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Where He's very worried about it. He's distracted in the moment. He doesn't get aroused. He doesn't perform well. He feels very badly about it. And then the next time he goes in with a negative attitude, oh my gosh, I hope it doesn't happen again. Then it happens again for all those same reasons. And then it just becomes this vicious feedback, positive feedback loop, which just keeps reinforcing it and making it worse and worse. What we could do is we could prescribe him medication, which, no matter if he's distracted or not, is going to lead to an erection, because it works directly on blood flow to the penis, and it's going to cause him an erection, whether or not he's distracted or in this kind of negative mood state or what have you. And then that will lead to successful performance, thus making him feel better about himself and kind of reversing that whole vicious cycle. So we could use medication as a sort of psychological treatment, for lack of a better way of saying it. Okay? And then for women, this is newer. They kind of call it pink Viagra. And this is basically a kind of medication that increases sexual interest and arousal in women. It's known as flibanserin. Its generic name is listed there. I believe you pronounce it Adderall. I'm not 100% sure. But again, kind of with the same premise as trying to increase arousal by a direct biological mechanism. Okay. All right. Oh, and I should say that that has not been found to be as effective for women as the medications for men. Okay, moving on to psychological interventions. You'll notice here that I don't even kind of bring up psychodynamic therapy because it just has not been found to be effective at all for psychological sexual dysfunctions. However, cognitive behavioral therapy has been found to be effective. And you'll notice, probably one of the reasons why I became a cognitive behavioral psychologist, is CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, is very effective for almost all disorders. There are some where psychodynamic therapy is actually better suited, and we'll talk about that in our next lecture set. But CBT is really effective for the large majority of disorders. And when somebody says they practice sex therapy, basically they're practicing cognitive behavioral therapy, but more specifically focused on sexual dysfunctions. Okay? That's all sex therapy is. It's basically a very specific version of cognitive behavioral therapy. So, how do we help people with these different kinds of sexual dysfunctions? Well, like traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, we're going to work on combating any negative thoughts that could interfere, such as, thinking that it's going to be a bad experience, or thinking that, they're not going to perform well, or thinking that there's, getting too down on themselves, that I'm a failure, there's something wrong with me, who's ever going to want to be with me because I have this problem, right? All these, real self-defeating kind of thoughts that people can have that we're going to try to combat and attack and set them straight to a healthier kind of self-concept or self-esteem and get them thinking more positively about themselves. Combating any kind of negative views that could have happened as a result of their culture. If cultural views make you feel badly about yourself, I would argue then they're not a good thing. Just because it's in your culture does not always mean it's good, or that maybe, it may have served a purpose at one point, but now it's leading to problems, right? So whenever different kinds of attitudes or views affect us negatively, and the person has a desire to change that, that's really, you know, par for the course for cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, the behavioral part of cognitive behavioral therapy is going to work more on behaviors or skills, right? Or exercises. And so for sexual dysfunctions, the exercises we're going to use are going to be those that direct one's attention on sexual stimuli and cues. And this has been known as sensate focus. So, you know, if the main culprit of arousal disorders or desire the disorders of desire, it has to do with a lack of attention. We want to teach these people how to really focus on sexual stimuli and cues. Like, how can we help them stay in the moment? You know, when you're in your head and you're thinking about, oh my gosh, what if this happens or what if that happens? Or, you know, I mean, just think of like the example, like, let's say somebody's distracted by work and they're not able to perform well sexually. I mean, that absolutely can happen. That's not uncommon. That's not a disorder. That happens many times to people. They're too distracted on something else going on in their life. And distraction, you know, is the enemy of being able to enjoy sex or any kind of activity that is going to be very pleasurable, right? I mean, if we're not able to stay in the moment, it's a problem. So that is a strategy that we're going to teach them in terms of really staying in the moment. And also, this will help women who have difficulties achieving orgasm, okay? Now, for men with orgasmic disorder, particularly premature ejaculation, there's the squeeze technique. That's where you squeeze the penis at the base of the head right before or a little bit more before they're about to ejaculate. If you do it too late, then it's not going to be effective. So you have to get the timing down in terms of knowing exactly when to squeeze so that, you know, you're not too close to orgasm where it's not going to work. Okay? You never thought you'd ever get instructions or lessons on this when you took my course, did you? Okay, what else does cognitive behavioral therapy for sexual dysfunctions entail? Well, a lot of it also has to do with teaching people about what is normal and what is expected. You know, some people will come into a clinic or with a practitioner, and the practitioner will quickly discover that you don't have a disorder. It's just that, you know, the amount of foreplay is not enough, that there's, you know, it's insufficient to lead to arousal. You know, the situation that you're describing, the sexual situation is just not sufficient to get you aroused. And so then we can teach them on what is sufficient and what kind of foreplay and what kind of sexual practice you can engage in to help you get more in the mood, so to speak. Okay? And some of that psychoeducation can include direct teaching of masturbatory techniques, proper, I say proper in the sense that, you know, not that there's proper and improper, but in the sense that what works for you, okay? So, you know, teaching somebody how to masturbate in a way that's going to give them pleasure and be fulfilling to them, okay? And also, with that being said, we can also teach people to pair masturbation with partner stimulation for women. That can help women who have orgasm difficulties, okay? So, you know, basically starting off with the partner, starting off with them learning how to masturbate, then the partner helps them masturbate, and then eventually that leads to penetration, and then with penetration also being clitoral stimulation, and then that being the end goal. In terms of being able to climax from actual sexual intercourse. And then also, in behavioral therapy, we always have this idea of, graduated exposure. And this can be used to, an exposure-based kind of technique for whenever anyone has any kind of anxiety, right? So we said a lot of times that the culprit between female genital pelvic pain penetration disorder is anxiety, and that leads to tensing up of muscles, and then, of course, that leads to very strained intercourse or unenjoyable intercourse, painful intercourse, and that's not good. So just like we would just how we would deal with anxiety disorders, we can also do exposure-based techniques that, you're gradually working up to the point of full penetration. That, you're starting with, using fingers and using different kinds of sex toys, and then eventually working your way up to them being relaxed enough to actually have sexual intercourse. Okay, I think I went into enough detail on those techniques. That's enough for this course, especially at a Catholic university. All right, now, family and systems therapy is also can play an important role, particularly when there are couples issues that are leading to sexual problems. And, again, if there are couples issues leading to sexual problems, we wouldn't say that this is a sexual disorder, right? For each, for either person, we'd say that this is a couples problem, right? But still, it's important to understand that, when people come to you for help, that this is another set of techniques or another strategy you can employ if you do discover that this is the culprit behind their sexual difficulties, right? Is that they are having couples difficulties, there's a lot of tension between them and their partner, a lot of emotional distress, what have you. A lot of fighting, communication difficulties, so that couples therapy can help the couple work on communication difficulties, work on a healthier relationship, and then that, of course, can set the stage for a healthier sexual relationship. Okay, so I think we're about at the hour mark, which is where I like to leave off for a lecture. An hour of lecture, plus if you've watched the videos, equates to about an hour and 20 minutes or so, which is about a typical class, right? So this is a good spot to leave off. And for the second part of the lecture, we will then be talking about paraphilic disorders and gender dysphoria. Okay, until then.